Evening all, this is Izzy Borshoff and you're listening to WMFO Medford. Welcome to another episode of In Your 20s, a show where I interview people each week about navigating that perilous decade of your early adulthood. So each week we've been discussing a different facet of 20s life. We've talked about leadership, we've talked about finding a moral compass, and this week I'm talking to Chidi, who's a classmate of mine at the Harvard Kennedy School. And he's here to have a chat about masculinity and modern dating in your 20s. So welcome, Chidi. How are you going today?
I'm doing great. Ready for finals. Happy time.
Living the dream.
A week from now is the dream.
A week from now when you'll be back in California. In California. Properly living it.
Well, my face doesn't hurt when I walk outside and breathe cold air.
Yeah, I feel ya. Australia's going to be good too. So thanks so much for coming in. And I think we might as well just dive straight into the heavy stuff. So I'm kind of interested in why you wanted to talk about masculinity, because I think it can be kind of tricky to talk about in today's environment. There's a general consensus that the patriarchy can be damaging to boys as well as girls, but it's also a tricky time to talk about it because we've had this recent very major breakthrough in shining the spotlight on the long silenced challenges of being a woman. So why do you think it's important to talk about masculinity at this point in time? And maybe you can tell us a little bit about when you started reflecting on your own experience of masculinity.
Sure. So I wouldn't say that it's necessarily tied to the specific moment in time, but obviously there's implications on, like, you know, Me Too and conversation that we have. And I think that so much of the popular narrative about masculinity is predicated in the toxic strain of masculinity. Not saying that all masculinity is toxic, of course not, but that there is the predominant hegemonic mode of masculinity is usually predicated in this insecure masculinity that constantly has been reproven through either domination, through violence, through coercion. And I think it's really important for us to have understanding of masculinity that's broad and encompassing, that allows men to be something besides this narrow traditional notion of masculinity. So, like, men who exhibit behaviors that perhaps aren't traditionally correlated with masculinity don't feel as if their identity is challenged, at or masculine and feminine aren't seen as opposed things, where, like, masculine is being not feminine, feminine is being not masculine, where there's more fluidity and people feel more comfort being somewhere on that spectrum and choosing to identify however they so choose.
Thanks. Yeah, so that really makes sense. And I'm eager to bring it back to your experience and whether you've found that a difficult thing to navigate or you've come up against those expectations in your life, in whatever communities you've been a part of, school, other friendship groups.
Sure, no, totally. So as I think all people have my own unique experience, and I think for me growing up, it was interesting, like, being very into these traditionally masculine things like sports and, you know, loving toys and action movies and all these type of things. So always conceive myself as a boy, conceive myself as masculine, and all the typical things you associate with that. But at the same time, you know, always having this depth and sensitivity and connection with my emotions that I don't think aren't masculine, but you don't traditionally see reflected in media images of how men are supposed to act. So it was this interesting development of having the ability to kind of portray externally these traditional nodes of masculine, like being good at basketball or whatever it might be, being able to, like, hang out with the boys and, like, do all physical activities or engage in the, now as an old man, I can look back and immature conversations about, like, about girls and cooties and stuff like that, like doing, you know,
what no locker room talk, I hope.
not the type that Donald Trump talked about. I never have been in those locker rooms, but I also, you know, never had $1 million gift from my father. So, you know,
yeah, we all start in different places, exactly. But basketball court banter for sure.
Yeah. And then, like growing up and then, you know, going through adolescence and where everyone's hyper aware of their bodies, of their voice, when their voice starts cracking in class and, like, you know, you want to sound a certain way, you want to present a certain way, you want to dress a certain way. And I think there's this pressure to fit in because you want to belong because you're growing and finding new identities and interacting in new social circles. And for me, it was trying to navigate this space between wanting and feeling the certain way about my masculinity, but seeing that it wasn't popularly represented. And that was a difficult thing to kind of navigate. And like, for example, when I finished high school, what I applied to initially was to do nursing. And nursing isn't something that traditionally is very male dominated. So as someone who, like, you know, did well academically and like had a lot of options, people were kind of like, why would you choose nursing, you know? But the way I saw it is like a way to help people. It was a way to combine like my love for science and my academic skills in a very practical, applied way. And now I'm no longer, you know, studying nursing, but I think that just is kind of representative of the difficulties and the pushback you get when you start doing things outside of the norm. And I think responding to that and like finding the language has been a lifelong journey, something that now and I have, I'm very well versed in having those conversations.
And do you think that particular experience of kind of testing the bounds of your masculinity is unique to a high school period where it's, there's a kind of extreme pressure to be homogenous and to fit in. Have you found that it's improved markedly, or you have the flexibility to explore different ways of being a man much more in your 20s, or do you think those problems still press?
Sure. So it's definitely not that same like hyperbaric chamber that high school is, for sure. And I think, you know, there are more popular representations of alternate forms of masculinity available now, whether or not that's based off of gender identity, sexuality, or just like representations of people in different roles, whether or not it's as a homemaker or having jobs or roles in TV and film that, you know, we didn't see like in the 90s or in the 80s and things like that. I think that's a new thing. But as someone who like worked in a high school, so I did college advising before I came to the Kennedy School, like I still see the same kind of narratives playing out at that same adolescent age. You know, people trying to fit in and like a lot of their identity being predicated on traditional modes of masculine behavior, and a lot of it being about like we're not it's getting girls or presenting themselves in a very like macho type of way. So while I think as the adult population is having a conversation about this, and I think I hear it within, you know, these high schools, there still is that overarching traditional norm that men and boys are still grappling with.
Yeah, and I think it's certainly an interesting time that we're having sort of a more public debate about this question. I was interested recently, I read an article about an Australian comedian called Hannah Gadsby, who you may or may not have heard of. She did a stand-up special called Nanette that was really popular. And she basically talked recently about this idea of the good man and how the whole notion of needing to kind of capitalize on the good men in our society to help weed out or confront the bad ones was really problematic, because what you end up having is a situation where men are constantly defining who the good man is, and they can move the boundary and always make sure they're on the good and not the bad side of it. So I wonder if actually debating the essence of masculinity is a way to get around that. Here's a man, we have a good one and a bad one, that kind of dichotomy, and actually talk more about how we need to reshape our whole conception of what it means.
No, I think that's a really good point. And particularly at kind of like that dichotomy between good and bad, I think it's very dangerous for the reasons like you, that you allude to and that she alludes to, that when we can label good or bad, those who can slide themselves into that good label then kind of are exonerated. And like don't necessarily have to do the same day-to-day work to maintain that goodness. It's kind of like, I'm good, I'm redeemed, and those people are bad, and they're beyond redemption. I think that's dangerous in and of itself. In addition to that, I think it puts a burden on people who perhaps, people who are well-intentioned, are people who have done the work to like look within themselves and think about like where these ideas of masculinity are coming from, or like any notion of privilege, that they then are tasked with the work of, like, I'm supposed to bring this person across the rope, or I'm supposed to bring this person to enlightenment, versus, like you said, like, redefine it from its very essence, from breaking it down, like, what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? And I think having these conversations in concert are necessary. And to kind of give perhaps like some kind of practical basis to that, or like, I guess maybe a more abstract take on that. I think the issue is when we try to ascribe an essence, like, this is, a man is supposed to be this, a man is supposed to have this type of work, he's supposed to, at this age, have this sort of accomplishment, and that a woman, by dint of being a woman, is supposed to have these essential skills. We're not, it's being a homemaker, or being good with kids, or being able, you know, to do something that we prescribe someone to do before they've had a choice to decide whether or not that's something that is right for them. I think that's the thrust of where we should be getting, is where people then get to choose activities that aren't harmful to themselves and are harmful to others. And like, this is what my masculinity is, this is what my femininity is, and that not being restricted to any one specific type of way and being. It's an expansive category and spectrum where people can fit along.
I'm interested in what got you thinking about all of these things initially. I mean, obviously, as you said, you wanted to do nursing after you finished school, and that brought about some questioning from maybe your peer group and your community. But you obviously had the strength. I mean, you didn't end up doing nursing, but you had the strength to pursue things that interested you regardless of the constraints that you maybe felt like society was putting on you at the time. Is that something that came from your family environment, your parents, your older brothers, or was it through interactions you had at school, or just an inherent sense that you wanted to be more than perhaps a stereotype might suggest you should be?
Sure. And I think that last part that you said right there, trying to be more than a stereotype, because for me, I think my approach to be more critical about my masculinity is a really, it's an intersectional thing. Because I'm not just a man, I'm a black man. And like, I think my baseline understanding of race and the restrictions around race, like what I was supposed to be, where I was allowed to go, both like from the external society, but also within my family unit, where like my parents were afraid of me, you know, walking down certain streets at night, having a hoodie on, and all these restrictions are placed on your behavior, both from people who want you to be safe and those who are completely unconcerned with your safety whatsoever, and see your blackness as a sign of inferiority, of, you know, not belonging, of always trying to constrain you to fit somewhere along their agenda. And as I became more and more well versed in my blackness and in talking about race, I realized what it meant to be not just man, what it meant to move through this world as a black man. So like, having this privileged identity, but while at the same time having this marginalized identity, and like what that meant for me, and understanding that I like the concept, which is not a hot take whatsoever, racism is dumb and it shouldn't exist, and people shouldn't be defined socially or economically, or have these things predetermined where they can go, where they can move, because of, you know, something they have no control over, what they're born into, even though race is a social construct. And I think I kind of built from that and thought about, like, I want to be a fully actualized human being. And that means I need to be able to make agentive choices about, you know, who I associate with, how I live my life, what I dress, you know, what music I listen to. And that meant not having these strictures put on me, to me, by what I'm supposed to do as a boy or what I'm supposed to look like as a man. Whatever I choose to do is what a man does. Like, there's no, I'm not failing to meet this masculine preconception. Like, I already am a man, and what I do is therefore masculine. And I think trying to parse out, like, this is masculine behavior, this is feminine behavior, like, we're trying to essentialize these things to being male or female, when really these are just human traits. Like, I choose to identify as a man, and the whole conceit of who I am throughout my daily life and what I choose to be and how I choose to treat other people is what makes me a man. It's not this static category. It's something I choose and define and redefine every single day of my life.
That's really interesting, and particularly enlightening, because I was going to ask you about how being a person of color plays into your masculine identity, which you've kind of drawn out there. And I'm interested in your reaction to in the era of Me Too, the conversational trope of the straight white male who sort of becomes the center of our discourse around gender in today's age, and whether that characterization of the problematic male, how your identity as a person of color plays into that. And does that, do you think the perspectives that you have from growing up as a black boy and a black man shape your understanding of this whole conversation around Me Too and gender in a particular way, as in you have more sympathy for the victims perhaps of an oppressive and white patriarchal structure, or is it confusing to be a part of that conversation?
No, it's not confusing. So I'm glad you brought this up. So it's kind of related to something I did as an undergrad when I went to UC Santa Barbara. I worked, as you know, colleges love all their acronyms. So I worked for the WGSE, which is the Department for Women, Gender, and Sexual Equity. And then within that, worked for CARE, which is Campus Advocacy, Resource, and Education, which is basically focused about interpersonal violence prevention. And part of like my year-long project was really thinking, like, as the only man working in this space, you know, which is very like feminist and progressively minded, like, could I just be trying to replicate the work that like women are doing that doesn't really make sense for me to be doing that? Like, what can I, or how can I specifically use my identity to be uniquely effective? So that's why I started doing a program around toxic masculinity and talking about that, like, as a man talking to other men about, you know, how this hurts us and the people in our lives, and how we need to reform and root out this toxic strain of masculinity so we can have a healthy, you know, fully realized version of masculinity. And one of the things I wrote an op-ed, because we had this organization come, they were called Men Can Stop Rape. So it's basically men talking about sexual violence, domestic violence, and also toxic masculinity, like all the things wrapped up in gender violence or gendered violence. And one of the things I talked about is like how traditionally in this country, narratives of false, you know, sexual assault allegations have been pointed towards black men, specifically with white women, and what that's meant for like lynchings, race riots, like actual real life death and destruction of lives and of communities, because of this specter of like this black lascivious man and this pure white woman, whose dignity be protected from, you know, from this threat. And I say that to say, like, if anyone should be concerned about false allegations, I think is typically the pushback, you know, with this movie
too. Sure.
Yeah.
No evidence.
Exactly. Yeah. He said, she said that, you know, we're convicting people in the with public trials with no traditional legal process. So if anyone should be the most afraid of that, that should be me. But I'm not afraid of it. And the reason why I'm not afraid of it is because I know the statistics and like how rare it is for a false allegation to happen, but beyond that, how rare it is for a conviction to happen in a sexual assault case and in domestic violence, because we don't listen to women. And why don't we listen to women? Because the people who are in power, in positions of power, and whether or not it's political power, formalized power, or informal power in the social sphere, are men, traditionally white men, and they set the rules and the norms around the conversation that we have. So like almost any allegation that's going to come against a man, it's going to be asking, you know, was she drunk or inebriated in some way? What was she wearing? You know, she's after him for his money. Like, there's all these narratives that like come to mind and spring to mind that immediately discount the narratives of women. But also, you know, want to be very conscientious that women, while they are unfortunately the predominant victims of sexual assault, you know, boys and men are also sexually assaulted as well. Not to try to
I understand, not to paper over the statistics on who's more likely to be assaulted, exactly. But it does happen to
And it's so important, because I think really what we make a choice as a society. You know, are we comfortable with, you know, having the vast majority of, you know, survivors, predominantly women, not being listened to, not having any justice, you know, occur in, you know, the traumatic experiences that they had? Or are we willing to change that tide and, you know, put the burden on people who are sexual assaulters, like for them to then have a higher conviction rate, for them to actually go to trial, for like, there be a space where people who are the victims actually feel as society is going to listen to them when they come up to speak. And right now, that's not the environment that we've created, because it's one that's very much predominated by the chance and the specter of the male typically being innocent and the woman making up a story. That's the predominant narrative. And what would it mean for us to shift that burden, that social burden, and the conversation that we have, where we don't presume a woman to have to justify what happened to her, or any survivor of assault to have to justify for it. So that's why I'm very pro Me Too, if that wasn't clear. Because all of this is tied deeply together. Intersectionality is a word thrown around all the time. But oppression happens across race, across gender, across ability, across identities. And if we're not talking about these things together in concert, then really what we're doing is moving people up and down an inherently flawed hierarchy of social privilege and social understanding of, and having voices valued or devalued. We, like, all this needs to happen in concert and in a very conscientious way. So I hope I'm answering your question.
Thanks, Chidi. That was a very comprehensive answer. So we might go to a song break now, and then after that, I will get Chidi to read one of our required public service announcements. So Chidi, do you wanna take it away with another tune?
Sure, I would love to.
What are we gonna be listening to?
Let's get this is Sango, and it's just basically like him mixing some Portuguese music, and it sounds great.
Sounds good. Here we go. And we're back. I'm just going to turn off that aux. Still learning how to use the equipment, clearly.
All good.
All right, Chidi, do you want to take it away? I haven't given you very much time to choose a PSA, but maybe you can just do a bit of a lucky dip situation.
Sure. Go with the education. All right. So, hey, wake up. You can't dream your way into college. There are actual steps you need to take. Steps that go beyond just getting good grades and staying out of trouble. Truth is, there's stuff you could be doing as early as 7th grade to start preparing. So if you're really serious about college, visit knowhowtogo.org. It spells out everything you need, starting with one step, finding an adult who can help. For the rest of the steps, visit howtogo.org today. Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation for Education, and the Ad Council.
Thanks, Chidi. I feel like you picked one that was actually very relevant to your interests and your skill set.
Yeah, so I saw the education tab and I went right for it.
Yeah, couldn't resist. Well, we might take the conversation in a slightly lighter direction and talk a bit about how all this stuff that we've just been chatting about plays into the modern dating landscape. So I'm kind of interested in whether you think dating apps themselves, if that's where we start off, alleviate some of the anxiety around the performance of masculinity in dating, in terms of you both, when you're on an app, you both know that you're there because you have an interest in a particular romantic outcome. You might not know yet if it's with that person, but does that, as a guy, alleviate some of the anxiety around completely misreading the situation, say, in a bar or a party? Or is it the reverse? And is there kind of this pressure to perform a particular kind of masculinity on technology?
No, I think that's a really good question. And I think, as with all things, it varies, which I know that's a horrible response to give, but I'll dig into that a little bit deeper. I'll at least take my personal perspective and like maybe try to speak to some larger concepts after that. So for me personally, I've always been a very introverted person. And also someone who's very terrified of coming off as creepy. So, like, I probably missed a lot of shots in life just because, like, you know, it's not 100%. It might be 95. I'm not even going to risk it unless I absolutely know. So there's that kind of person grounding in that. In terms of dating apps, so I haven't used them for, like, I know they exist for a long time. I haven't used them as much as some other people have, but I use it, you know, for a few months. And there's some good and bad to it. So I think the good notion is that, like, through my bio, I can kind of, like, signal to people, like, my interests and my thoughts that you can't necessarily signal someone when you meet them in person. Like, unless I'm wearing, like, my Arrested Development t-shirt, you know, you don't really have a sense of my personality.
Your Childish Gambino one that gets whipped out.
Childish Gambino. This is a conversation about Childish
Gambino. I'm distracting you.
No, but also someone who could be interested to talk about in terms of masculinity, specifically black masculinity. But we'll come back to that later after we finish talking about dating apps. So I can kind of signal, you know, my interests, like, including Black Lives Matter. So, like, I'm not trying to date racist people. So you got to have things like that. But showing, like, my interests in music and in politics. So, like, I know I will need to talk about these things, so I can kind of signal things ahead of it. But then conversely, I think what kind of reinforces some of these traditional masculine behaviors is there's this expectation that, like, you as a man are going to message first. You're going to be one who's forward. You're going to be one initiating the interaction for the most part. Because just by nature of, I guess, human nature or the gendered reality we've created, women have way more men trying to match with them than men tend to have women trying to match with them. Unless you're Idris Elba or Ryan Gosling, that's usually kind of how they're...
Yeah, the statistics are kind of staggering. I don't want to misquote them, but I'm pretty sure statistics for how many women men swipe right on, right is yes, right?
Yeah.
how many women men swipe right on is sort of up between like 60-80%.
Mm.
And for women and the reverse, it's like 6% of males or something. Yeah.
Because men are kind of trash. On the general. You know, we try to be good.
So self-deprecating.
You know, I mean, we can't get anywhere without honesty. So there's kind of that general thing. Like, basically, I have a lot of choices. You better shoot your shot. You better shoot it straight. Versus when you meet someone in the club or in the bar or in the library, wherever millennials meet nowadays, there's not like 10, 15 people standing behind you being like, if you mess up, I'm going to talk to the person like right behind you. Versus, I think there's kind of like that sense in the digital world that like you have a limited amount of time. Whether real or just perceived, this sense of there's a plethora of options, if not you, you know? So I think that then can create some very ugly, I've seen lots of screenshots from my female friends of some very weird opening messages, horrible, cringy pickup lines or whatever it might be, because you're trying to make this strong impression to kind of beat out the competition, so to speak. But then, as if it's not clear enough already, I have lots of critiques of traditional masculine and gender roles. I think then what happens is people are forced to portray a side of themselves that they may not necessarily actually resent of who they are. So like, I have to do this to then be able to get this person's attention, and like maybe then I can be real on that side of things. And I think it fosters this like I'm here, impress me, versus we're two people meeting and we're trying to hash it out and figure out, are we compatible, are we interesting, you know, is there chemistry here? I think there's like a potential for that, but it doesn't happen as much in the digital world, where it's easier, like if someone says something that you kind of aren't feeling, just like, ah, you know, unmatch, find someone else. Versus in a one-on-one conversation, like in real life, like you might ask them like, well, what did you mean by that? And then you can maybe dig into whether or not the person's socially anxious, or, you know, if they're just had an awkward moment, like you could maybe move past that.
There's less opportunity for back and forth in those early stages in the digital world.
Exactly.
And I kind of want to double back on something you said before about being able to signal your interest. So you can mention Black Lives Matter or something else political, or your music tastes. Do you think that dating apps make us more judgmental? In terms of, if I meet someone at a party and have a chat, I might talk about something completely inane with them, but I have a sense that there's chemistry and I want to get to know them better. And then I might later go and look on their social media and be like, mm-hmm. oh, that looks a bit sketch, but I'll talk about it with them next time.
Sure.
Whereas when you're on a dating app, you can almost immediately write someone off if there's something in their profile that you just feel is not really you. And I mean, maybe that works out for the better in the end, but also, are we kind of losing the opportunity to have meaningful discussions and challenge each other because we're just avoiding those people?
No, I think that's a good point to bring up. Obviously, people are using dating apps for different reasons. Some people are like literally just trying to meet friends. Some people are trying to find something casual. Some people are trying to find their marriage partner, you know. So there's like this vast range of options. And I think they encourage people to be very superficial and make, you know, quick decisions. And kind of like as you're alluding to, because it's like literally, if not this person, there's a never-ending stack of faces and names and stuff like that. So, one, people are making superficial decisions, they're also making very snap decisions. And, like, one thing, like, I notice is, like, you kind of usually tell that when you actually match with someone and start having a conversation. So, it's like, some people, when I match with them, will have a conversation about, like, you know, this really cool picture they had when they were in Cuba. Or, like, they'll say, oh, you listen to Anderson .Paak? That's awesome. I saw him, like, last week. And then we had, like, a really meaningful conversation. So I think there is a room to kind of, like, break the ice that can happen over these digital platforms. But also at the same time, it might be someone asked me a question that was answered in my bio. I'm like, so clearly you didn't read this bio. You just saw, like, I decided this man's face is good enough for me to, like, decide to engage with him. And so then I think sometimes there is for sure a superficial component of that. And to kind of, like, maybe segue into something else, I think there's also the danger of people trying to use these apps to seek validation. You know, it's like seeing, you know, those, that red icon, app icon, like bling, and the notification someone just matches, someone's answering it. Like, it becomes very easy to try to, like, commodify your worth and your attractiveness to other people because of how many matches you have, how many conversations you're having, who you're meeting up with, how many dates you're going on, stuff like that. And I think it also elevates people's, you know, FOMO, fear of missing out on something. It's like, all right, well, you know, I'm talking to these two or three people. Who am I not talking to? And I think it's when it's laid out in a very, like, physical or graphical user interface, becomes very easy for people to try to, like, juggle all these different connections and not really focus on forming one deep, meaningful one. Because trying to figure out, well, maybe, you know, what's my marginal benefit?
You're literally getting a dopamine hit every time you get a match. Exactly. With the little, so the incentive is almost just to keep swiping and matching with people rather than stop and move on with your life.
Deep connection with someone. So I think that's a harm of this, but they're a tool. It can be used for good or bad. And one thing that is good, I think, is it's a way to meet and connect with people who you maybe never would have met or connected with before. Someone goes to a different university, someone lives 5 miles away, and like you'll never interact with them on your route home or when you go out at night. So I think there's the potential to have some very cool, unique, and potentially deep, intimate, meaningful connections and conversations with people, which I have had been able to have. But then it's also easy to become very jaded and pessimistic and like see these things as something that I don't think they should reflect our human worth or define how we connect as human beings. So I think this is a medium, and then we then have to connect offline. But it's just a medium of connection, but it shouldn't be where
it doesn't replace.
Yeah.
It's also interesting because I think like so many topics, this can just go both ways. So you said it gives you the opportunity to meet people outside the circles you normally would socialize in. And I totally agree with that. And I think we also see some of the dangers in being able to silo your dating interests really specifically, and that often plays out in terms of like race is an obvious question. So there's quite a lot of publicity around how different racial groups are treated or affected by online dating, and there's a pretty well-known phenomenon of fetishization of the Asian woman, and that's like something tricky for people to navigate online. Another example is I was talking to a friend about JSwipe, the Jewish dating app, and you can put how you identify in terms of your, I guess, your level of religiosity. Uh-huh. But then some guys who are on there don't actually identify as Jewish at all, but they just have willing to convert in their tagline, which is just kind of like, cool, you're just creeping on Jewish girls here. So I'm wondering, what are your views on that, and is that something you've had to navigate?
Sure, that's a very large question. Being in Boston, which is a city with a rich, deep history, and also still very much segregated city, I've had some interesting experiences with that. But to talk kind of like in a larger concept, like, you know, there is very much, as much as people like to imagine we're in a post-racial colorblind society, it's not even close to being the case whatsoever. And it's always been fascinating to me. Like, I do my best to screen out this, but like, people are human beings and like are good at presenting certain facades and certain social faces. Like, when I will, you know, have a conversation or like decide to meet someone up in person, and like one of the first things that is out of their mouth is something about like blackness or me being black or how many black friends they have and how they're good at dancing and they love hip hop and bass. I'm like,
God,
how is this a real thing that's happened to me in real life? And like, I'm not even exaggerating, this isn't hyperbole whatsoever. That people, and I think it's very easy, like as you said, like with dating apps, to like literally categorize people, like, you know, and I think with Hinge specifically, you can kind of pick, you know, some things that I think make sense, like lifestyle choices, your religion, if you drink, if you do illicit drugs or anything like that. But there's also like a racial category, and you can select which races you see. And I'm like, that seems like a horrible thing to build into a platform. But at the same time, maybe I don't want to be accidentally matched with someone who has like is racially exclusionary or whatever it might be, or has racist ideologies. But I think it's...
Presumably, once you see each other's photos, that is something that maybe sorts itself out.
You would think, but in some conversations I've had with like friends whose phenotype isn't obviously one race or another, or they have mixed races.
Right, okay, that makes sense.
Like, a lot of their initial comments, like, what are you? Which is a question that has lots of issues.
And that's like a way worse version of the, where are you from? Yeah. No, where are you really from?
Yeah, no, yeah. Totally. And it's kind of like, sliding people into these categories, like, you know, we're not, it's African American, it's, you know, Asian, white, blonde, working professional, artist. Like, you're kind of like searching for these labels and these identities versus understanding the person for whoever they might be. Like, sure, like, obviously our identities, our jobs, our family backgrounds inform who we are, but I think there is a danger that these apps present to then seeing people just as reflections of the category you're trying to seek out. And I mean, maybe this is asking a lot for a dating app to do, but encouraging people to be more critical about their selection of partner and mates. Like for example, someone tells me they're not attracted to black women. There's tall black women, there's short black women, there's skinny black women, there's thick black women, there's black women who are PhD. There's black women of all different, you know, physical identities, of mental capacities, of social categories, that for you to then say that you don't like black women means you have an issue with the race of the woman. And I don't think people, it's very easy to say, oh, I have this preference, versus for people to really dig down, like, well, where does that preference come from? Why do you have that preference? And is it rooted in some very problematic, you know, roots?
How do you respond when you confront people who, so both people who come on dates with you and immediately try to talk about, who immediately try to refer to your blackness in some way that they presumably think is either flattering or funny, or guys or friends who speak about black women in that way? How do you respond to that kind of thing? Do you respond in the way you just responded to me?
I still have some level of social decorum, or attempting to be a socially decent human being. So when it happens on a date, I think it's kind of like, and well, you can see I have a very flat affect. So I just kind of am like, interesting. Tell me a little bit more.
Just
about
slotted
that.
That one away.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit more about how good you are at dancing.
Sure. And it's not even like, I don't even get angry about it, because really what it is, it's sad. Like, I pity the person, because like that's like the damage of what like American white segregation, and like beyond that, just people's living in racially segregated worlds, both like physically because of housing discrimination and people's social bubbles, is that you have such an anemic understanding of what it means to be black that you don't even know how to interact with me. Like, you don't even know how to, like, this is so present at the forefront of your mind that like this is an exception to what I normally interact with, and let me try to put you at ease, or let me try to prove to you that like I understand who you are, versus just interact with me as a human being and seeing if we have some sort of chemistry or some sort of compatibility. And I think that's like the broad damage of a society that doesn't understand its history, that doesn't reflect on the value of diversity in the school, in work, where you can't understand people, where you don't know how to interact with people because you've never been exposed to them. But even, it's not just exposure itself, but you have never formed a meaningful connection with someone of my race or of my background, that you can't see me as anything but this label, but some stereotypical manifestation in your mind. Or conversely, people who perhaps aren't saying that aloud, but are trying to like prove to themselves that they're not racist by dating someone outside of the racial group, which is not the solution, nor is having a bunch of mixed brown babies going to solve racism, which I don't know, maybe some people think that like because I, you know, am married or sleep with people of a certain races, I can't possibly be racist. But fun fact, you know, misogynists still sleep with women. Like, who you sleep with doesn't make you
the older I have daughters or I have a mother argument.
Exactly.
And so the question of diversity then, what about politics? Do you actively screen for politics, or would you date someone who has very different political views to you, bar them being offensive? Like, I imagine there's an intersection of diverse political view and views on race that is not in any way excusable.
Sure. It's interesting because obviously, like, I'm a man who and I'm heterosexual, so I only see women's profiles. So, like, I've a good amount, like, I'll see, like, you know, Trump voters swipe left. Like, some solution, like, if you mess with Trump, like, don't talk to me type of thing. And while I don't have anything like that, I think my politics comes out pretty clearly. And I don't necessarily desire or need to have someone who, like, aligns with me 100% on these thoughts, but, like, very basic questions of, like, humanity and decency, like, that's just, if you don't have it, like, that's a non-starter. So it's not necessarily you have to see the world the way that I do, but if we disagree because we disagree about, like, the right implementation of creating a more equitable, fair, just world, sure. But if you see nothing wrong with our current social orientation, we have vastly different lenses of interacting with the world that I just think would make us dating incompatible to date.
Yeah, sure, sure. So just to kind of wind up the conversation, do you think the way we date, wind up with a huge question, do you think the way we date is fundamentally changing as the world changes? I mean, obviously we're getting married later. We have these apps. We're kind of navigating the world in a different way. Globalization means that we're often having to make decisions about relationships, kind of make or break decisions really quickly because we're all moving to different places. Do you think this is kind of a fundamental shift in the way we approach finding love and partners?
Sure. I'm not well grounded enough in the complete history of humanity to be able to comment on the extent of it. I do think it's changing. It's different from the past. Exactly in what ways those are different, I can do a one-on-one comparison, but I think some of my thoughts on it are that I think change is necessary, but we also have to be very conscientious of, like, which ways that we are changing, because change isn't always positive change. So, like, on one hand, you know, in an increasing global interconnected society, I think there's more opportunities for us to connect and really have meaningful relationships with people who we otherwise would have never seen before. Understanding what's going on in countries and in communities, both, you know, domestically and internationally, that we just wouldn't have had access to the media coverage or people sharing their thoughts and their views and perspectives. Then with, you know, since the 1970s, you know, there's been increasing, you know, gap between, you know, those, the haves and the have nots. And that's affecting, you know, people's decisions, and, you know, where not they, you know, go to college, where they have children later in life, you know, if they do get married, if they have kids, you know, there's all these things are impacted by the political and economic realities that we're living in. I think very much are having an impact on them. Then, like, for example, you know, in Japan, like, they're having an issue with the increasing aging population, but not having enough children to replace, you know, the replacement rate, which is about 2.2 children per family. So, like, just all these fundamental shifts to our world that, like, I think dating, like, must shift with that. Because dating or, like, finding a partner, and whether or not you decide to get married or not, is really, it's a social decision in a societal context of, like, you know, usually trying to find security or trying to find this, you know, maybe romantic ideal of love, our sense of, you know, purpose, our identity. And I think our identities are shifting so much in the current world that we live in, that people are also reevaluating what it means to have a partner, to be a partner, in ways that I think are good, to be questioning some of these underlying concepts, where or not it's just a postmodern, you know, existential malaise, it might be. Because I do think there are a lot of fundamental systems that we've never questioned before, and then as they start to break down, as they start to have fits and starts, we then start questioning about what type of social arrangements we should be having. And I think it's good for people to make choices about their partner, not out of, like, purely economic survival.
For sure.
You know, and I think that's what it was, you know, in earlier generations. It's conferral of property a very long time ago, but also conferral of social status, you know, to be a married woman, because it's always been more of a burden on women to get married than on men to get married. Married in a heteronormative society, that your identity and yourself, like, you shouldn't be incomplete because you aren't married, or you shouldn't be incomplete because you don't have a partner. And I think people being freer to make agentive choices of romantic attachment that's kind of the world that I want to live in. You know, where we're choosing to be partners, and we make that decision every single day, versus trying to follow a social script that's been prescribed to us, which also I think has connections to what we talked about earlier.
So a very graceful answer to an extremely broad final question, but I think what you're kind of getting at is that the change is good, but it's probably going to be accompanied by sort of more turmoil in the short term. So perhaps making this decade of being in your 20s an even more confusing one, but hopefully rewarding in other ways.
Definitely. And I think we have to embrace that turmoil. Like, change is not clean, it's not comfortable, but nothing good or worthwhile is ever going to be those things. And in that turmoil, in that, you know, that opportunity, we have a chance to gestate something new and meaningful, something that we've never seen before, to identify something that has no pretense and no precedent. I think that might be a beautiful thing. It's an opportunity for us to really build and make relationships and meaningful, intimate connections that, you know, we maybe couldn't have had 10, 15 years ago.
Great. Well, thanks so much for coming in today, Chidi. I'm gonna let you pick a song to finish us off with, but I'm glad we could finish on such an optimistic final note after our initial deep dive into the heavy stuff. So thanks for coming in, and yeah, take it away with a tune.
Cool, thanks for having me. I'm going to end on a nice note. It's You're the One by Catriona featuring Sid from The Internet.
You're the one.